The Market Musings Podcast. Well, hello everyone and welcome back to the Market Musings Podcast here from Stockbox, where today our guest Ian Stalker, the current Executive Chairman at Bradahead, is joining us, and sitting alongside as co-host is, of course, Dan Flynn. Welcome, Ian. First time that we're speaking. How are things?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks very much for having me on today.
No, it's very good to be speaking to you. You've got a very vast background in this sector, which seems to be having its time, long time coming, I think. I don't know if you would tend to agree on that. We'll get into that in a bit more, but it's good at the moment, isn't it? It certainly feels like it.
There's a comment that I was telling some guys here in Vancouver on Monday evening that was made by Robert Friedland, who's probably of a similar vintage to myself in terms of his mining background. But he said 2 years ago it was the revenge of the miners. And it actually is right now. The commodity market is just bouncing. It's been a long while. We've had different commodities having their time in the sun. But right now it's every commodity. It's quite amazing. It's quite amazing. And it's good for us.
Of course. Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. But Dan, all good with you?
Yeah, excellent. Like you're saying, it's a really exciting time to be in the space, and great time to speak to Ian and reflect on what he's learned over the years and perhaps absolutely what we can learn from it moving forward.
Absolutely. Well, Ian, I wonder if you could perhaps just introduce yourself a little bit. I know you've got a very vast history. I think it's 45 plus years in mining here. I know you worked with Euromin, and that, of course, was taken out for a very nice valuation. I know we've got a bit of a crossover there with George Roach, who we speak to at Premier African Minerals. But just perhaps take us back. You can go back as far as you like. I mean, maybe from the day you started getting interested in geology or mining or what attracted you to it. But potted history of yourself, if you can.
Well, it's interesting, Mark. The numbers you used, 45, are actually reversed. This is my 54th continuous year in the mining industry.
Ah, okay, sorry.
No problem. I probably tried to make myself younger than I actually am, so that's probably where 45 came from. But as a 21-year-old, I graduated up in Strathclyde University in Glasgow as a brand new chemical engineer and left to go to Zambia in that 1973 period. I went with a brand new wife and £10 in my pocket and joined the copper industry over there. At the time, the Zambian copper industry was a leader within the entire copper industry worldwide. People went from Zambia to all sorts of places worldwide, over in Australia, for example, and elsewhere for that matter, and did exceptionally well. So I ended up over there, and for my sins, having graduated as a chemical engineer, they then told me I was a metallurgist, which was a bit sort of unsettling. But I think, looking back now, that I've always had that ability to be flexible in my life, and that served me well. And so I became a metallurgist and started in the mining industry, and it's been absolutely phenomenal since that time.
So you started as a metallurgist. That's interesting. Was there anything that particularly attracted you to metallurgy?
Not really. As I say, it was a chemical engineering degree, and the Scottish system is somewhat different from the English educational system in that it's a lot broader. In England, you tend to narrow down your choices as you head towards your A-levels in your sixth year. So I ended up with a range of qualifications from French to history to English literature, as well as English itself, and then maths and chemistry and physics and so on. And so I had no clue what to do. I had a clever idea at the time in 1969. I applied to several universities in Scotland, one to do biochemistry in Aberdeen, two to do medicine in Edinburgh, three to do history with French in Glasgow, and four to do chemical engineering in Strathclyde. And my plan backfired because they all accepted me. And as a consequence, I then spent that summer panicking about what to do and chose, because my dad was an engineer, a tradesman, basically, as an engineer in a company just adjacent to our little village in Scotland. And so I guess just because of that connection, I decided chemical engineering was for me. And that's how I got into the mining industry.
Well, metallurgy is, of course, extremely important, more important with other commodities than others. Any key moments? 54 years is a long time. Any key moments that stand out to you? And I want to hear also about successes or, moments of real achievement. And also, moments of failure, if you can, or disasters or bad decisions, because of course we learn from these mistakes. And as we know, this industry is very, very risky and quite volatile. So any moments stand out for you?
Oh, several moments do. I mean, just being in Zambia itself was a huge challenge, as you can imagine. New country, new family, starting off and really being pretty naive, as most people are as a graduate. But getting involved there, and it was clear from the beginning that if I worked hard, there was opportunity. Because Zambia was a situation where, you know, people moved quite quickly. And in those days, you went over there to live. It wasn't like a contract that we have these days, you know, 6 weeks on and 2 weeks off and that kind of thing. You went over for 3 years before you got a long leave, as they called it, and you could come back to the UK to see mum, dads and things like that. And so that kicked me off. And that work ethic, which is typical Presbyterian in many ways, just stood me in good stead. And by working hard, I moved up to become what was known as concentrator superintendent. And we were making, just to give you an idea of the company in those days, was 400,000 tons of finished copper per year. So it was massive. And we had the entire complex of metallurgical plants, from concentrator to smelter to acid plant to oxygen plant to refineries to a cobalt plant, et cetera, et cetera, as a byproduct. And so I had the opportunity of getting involved in all these different operations and moving up the management ladder. And so that was, if you like, the first opportunity. And because in those days copper wasn't trading at the dizzy heights of $13,000 a ton as it is today, we had to also to mend and make do. And when you are in locations, you can imagine Africa, particularly in the 1970s, was nowhere near as easy to access, both by telephone, PC, or by flights. So you really were on your own. And so you had to learn how to make do and how to make decisions that, you know, stood the test of time. One of the things that sticks in my mind, for example, it seems very simple, and best ideas are very simple, to be quite frank with you, was that I had a bit of a problem with the tailings dams in Kitwe, was the name of the town where I was working in the Nkana concentrator, because when the dry season came, the wind used to whip up enormous amounts of dust, which was not good for anyone in the environment down there. And so I happened to live where my own house was down the bottom of that part of Kitwe, and towards that end there was a sewage plant, which wasn't run particularly well. And basically the trucks would come, collect the sewage, and then go and dump it in and a sort of refuse. And so I negotiated with them to bring the sewage to my little concentrator, where I had an old tank that I converted into what called a panchuka in those days, which was an aerated tank. And I then was able to use a redundant pipeline and pump this sewage to the tailings dam. And within one rainy season, the vegetation in that rain in those dams was phenomenal, and the dust was obviously significantly less. And within two rainy seasons, you started to see wildlife coming back to the area, not massive elephants, etc., but, you know, the small sort of rabbits and that kind of size of animal, and snakes and birds, etc. So I remember being quite pleased with that outcome. In actual fact, the council paid me for removing the sewage, and it turned out to be a home win. Yeah, no, so that kind of kicked it off. And then I went from there. I was there for about 14 years through to 1987. And then I went from there up to Ghana, which was quite a change, because Southern Africa at the time still had its own politics at play, particularly from the Southern African region, where apartheid was still the sort of number one political system. And Ghana, further up north, didn't have those kind of black-white issues in any shape or form. And I got up to Ghana, and my second day, I used to play a bit of sport. I was went to the World Championships at badminton while I was in Zambia. And then I was picked for the Zambian squash team. And I went up to Ghana, and they got chosen also for the Ghanaian squash team. And the second day at the shanty, I was telling guys, listen, I wouldn't mind a game of squash. Says, who should I play? And I played who was the best guy at the time in Obuasi, the little mining town. It was a good game. And then I said, anybody else to play? And they said, oh, there's this Ghanaian chap who comes along at lunchtime. So I pitched up and played this Ghanaian guy. And later on that afternoon, I got a phone call And the phone call was from the general manager, who, of course, was God on high in those days. And he said, did you play a Ghanaian at squash today? And I said, yes, sir, I did. He said, what was his name? I said, he's a hell of a nice guy called Sam. He said, Sam, you know who he is? I said, no, not really. He said, he's the CEO of the company. So suddenly our squash games became much more competitive, as you can imagine. But it turned out to be Sam Jonah, who was later in the late 90s knighted by the Queen and is now Sir Sam Jonah. Mm. And him and I got, and I suppose that started our relationship, and I went through the Ashanti time from 87 to 98. And as part of the team, I took the operation then that was producing 80,000 ounces a year, initially just by internal bits and bobs that were lying around the mine, and converted the little plant, upgraded it, got it running. It's hard to describe the changes, but it was quite something. At the old roasters, you couldn't see your nose in front of you. By the time I finished, you could have your dinner off the floor. But we converted that to 120,000 ounces a year. And then suddenly we had the opportunity of taking Ashanti by getting a loan from the World Bank and the IFC. We raised $500 million, which was a significant amount in those days. And we took that little company from that 80,000 all the way to 1 million ounces of gold per year, just shy of that in 1995, 96 year. And I became the general manager of the Ashanti Mine Expansion Project, which did all the development, including was instrumental in the world's largest bioxidation plant being installed in the middle of the African bush in Ghana, very successfully, I'm glad to say. And producing, as I say, the open pits. And the open pits in those days, we were moving somewhere around 55 to 60 million tons of dirt a year, which is a significant amount of rock in those days. And we were producing gold, fortunately, less than $100 per ounce, because gold was getting sold at $200-$300 an ounce. So it was a hugely successful operation that enabled us not only to move the company forward and get listed in New York. And we, at the time in New York, we had a great opportunity of meeting different people there, as you can imagine. We brought over the Ghanaian dance troupe, who opened the stock exchange that particular morning before they rang the bell for Ashanti Goldfields being listed. But we took that company through to that listing, and then started to become much more international. In fact, we were the leading company within the African environment in terms of gold mining. At the time, and you know, and second off the rank was AngloGold, who eventually bought us out in 1999-2000, in terms of becoming a much larger gold mining company. And companies like Randgold followed our lead significantly. And so, you know, the Mac Bristow, whom we got to know a little bit at the time, and did very well with Randgold, and he took our approach and our pedigree and copied it. And Ashanti then started moving into the international African environment. I had the good fortune of becoming the managing director of what was known as Group Projects. And we built a gold mine brand new in Bibiani in Ghana. I've talked about the Ashanti mine expansion, which was huge, as I mentioned. We put in a sulfide treatment plant, we put in an oxide treatment plant, we put in a heap leach, we put down shafts, changed the ventilation, mechanized the mine. And then we built another mine up in Siguiri in Guinea. We built another mine in Geita in Tanzania. And all three of these mines are still going well with huge endowments of gold and have been super mines from start to finish. And we also got involved in Zimbabwe at Frida Rebecca at that time, and a small mine also in Burkina Faso. So I spent a lot of time, a lot of wonderful years in West Africa, and I'd like to think that the successes we had building those mines and meeting the people we met, the whole range from top to bottom, stood me in great stead for what then became the venture into the junior market space.
Mm. That's really amazing. Interesting. And as a fellow squash player, it's good to hear that it served you so well. I was just going to ask, you mentioned a lot of jurisdictions there within Africa and also a lot of metals. Do you find that you have a preference in terms of both, or do you just, you know, go to opportunities that look good to you regardless of, you know, where they are or what metal they're in? It's just about their merit on a project by project basis.
Yes, I think that latter description probably fits better, that I assess the project, and I've been lucky enough that the bulk of them in fact, have been successful, and it's been a range. So, for example, in 2019, which brings us more recently, I had just happened to sell a lithium company, which was in Argentina. We sold it just at the end of the first wave of the lithium market space suddenly becoming attractive. And I was approached at that time to join a little helium company, which we then listed in London, and it's called Helium One. And, you know, it's a complete opposite of gold, silver, copper, uranium, nickel, etc. It was a gas, and I had to learn a little bit about that. But the opportunity was exciting. And I'm delighted to say that even that project now, and I shouldn't say even that project has become successful. They now have cash flow with a joint venture they've got in America, and they have had a pretty super discovery drill well done in Tanzania, which they're now doing some pump tests from, and I think will turn out very well. So, you know, if you consider that extreme on the helium side of things and the standard gold, and then we've had, you know, you're right, the things that become quite exciting, you know, we tend to follow the market. Lithium suddenly became the rage in 2016, 2017. Everyone had to have lithium opportunities. And so it went on. And then uranium. I mean, uranium was horrible in the late 90s, but by the beginning of 2000, we had all sorts of people telling us the world was coming to an end with climate change, etc., and that we should be looking at changing or moving away from, if you like, the hydrocarbon fuel side of the business to more clean energy. And the obvious candidate was then nuclear industry. And so we took up the tools of a little company called Uramin. Listed Uramin. We had no licenses initially at the end of 2005. Listed it in London in April 2006 for a market cap circa 15 to 20 million pounds. Got it relisted in TSX at the end of December 2006. We had got our first license awarded in 2006 and then had the good fortune of selling it from that small market cap in April 2006, that I mentioned, selling it in August 2007 for $2.5 million to the French company Areva. And I was, I'm delighted to say, the CEO of that company from start to finish. So that was a wonderful success. So when you talk about commodities, it really, for me, is what's the quality of the asset and does it have a chance of working? And it's also one of the things I've recognized that if you're going to be in the commodity business, I do honestly believe that you've got to have decent size. You've got to have a bulky opportunity. So the likes of Ashanti, for example, grew from 80,000 ounces to 1.7 when I left, 1 million within the Ghanaian context, plus or minus. And so that was a decent sized player. If you're just small, there's lots of small gold mining companies. There's even lots of small helium companies that will do okay, but they won't make you a fortune. So you've got to get into projects that have got bulk and you can grow and you can become a player in the marketplace, not just an add-on.
It's interesting you say that as well, that you need size. I mean, I was talking to a commodities investor in Zurich. Did a long podcast with him back just before the summer. And he said the same thing about gold. There's no point looking at a gold mine project that's less than 1 million ounces. I don't know if you would agree on that sort of number.
I certainly would. I mean, one of the other successes I had was back in 2013. I had been involved with a gold mining company in Fiji that I had brought to the table in 2007, just after the end of the Uramin, and we listed it in London called Vatakula. And it was in that part of the Pacific region, the Gold Rim area, where there's big mines. But this one had been operating since the 1930s. So the challenge in that one was, of course, the ore body had moved significantly far away from the infrastructure and therefore costs were that little bit higher. And gold hadn't yet taken off. But because of that knowledge of working in that arena, as opposed to just being an African hand or whatever else I might have been, you know, South American, we'll come on to that in a minute, or Australian, because I should say I built a mine in Australia at St Ives, a gold mine. I was headhunted, I guess, by Goldfields of South Africa. I became their vice president of projects and put St Ives together in 2004 and 5 that became a 500,000 ounce per year producer. But I got involved in 2013 because of that knowledge of that part of the world with a company called K92. There were four of us at the time. Two of my colleagues from there have passed on, unfortunately. That's the vintage we're at, I guess. And we had negotiated with a company called Barrick that I'm sure everyone's aware of, and we took it off their hands. They didn't want to be in Papua New Guinea, where the mine was situated. And they already had a mine there. This one hadn't worked out for them. And so we picked it off their hands for $2 million with a few other hooks in it, listed it in 2014 under the name of K92, the numbers 92. And that name came about because of my accent. When I used to present and say the mine was from K92, everybody used to say, "Ian, what are you saying? K92? So I converted K92 into K92. And that little business, because of its size that you're referring to, Mark, that little business is now a $6+ billion company, and is producing today, they reckon this year, 200,000 ounces of gold a year. And it's moving up, I think, to 400,000 within the next 24 months. And okay. It has got a massive resource and great gold, great grade.
Absolutely. It's always nice to get some metrics, isn't it, to go on. But of course, there's so many different commodities and things to consider. You'd take all day to do a podcast on covering, what's worth looking at. I mean, I'd like to generally, maybe something we can do one day with you, but I'd like to generally, because of course, where we are at the moment, and I mean, I look every day and I can't believe what I'm seeing in the metals prices, particularly of course, gold and silver. There was something that I was told by a serial CEO in the mining, a junior mining sector, who's seen at least two cycles, I think. And he said, you're in a mining bull cycle when you wake up every morning and you know you're going to be richer. You just don't know by how much. And I said this to someone the other day, and I just had an epiphany moment. And I thought, heck, we're living in that now, because I'm looking at my net worth kind of calculator every day, and it's just getting more every day, mostly driven by physical gold and silver. And I did actually sell some of my silver recently. I just thought it was a prudent thing to do, since I'd held it since about 2020, and I'm basically four times on the money. And actually, that's quite a funny story, because I was ringing around. This particular silver's in the UK, and I rang a couple of dealers who perhaps wanted to buy it, because I don't live in the UK at the moment. And one of them gave me a price I thought was okay. So I rang my dad and said, "Dad, do you mind digging out this silver?" I told him where it was, and taking it to this guy, and take the cash and work it out later. And he just said, "Oh, do you know what? Actually, I'll just buy it off you," because he's sort of buying that kind of thing at the moment. He's sort of retiring and all that kind of thing that's going on. So he basically bought it off me. So ironically, eventually, I'll get it back anyway.
There you go. Well, it's funny you tell that story, because a very similar parallel at that 2019, when I had just sold the lithium company, I was at the Bank of Montreal conference down in Miami. And for the first time in about 15 years, I actually had time to go to various meetings rather than having my own investor meetings in that. And I went to listen to three companies in particular. One was Cameco, because of the uranium story. I always liked that. The other was Kazatomprom, and the other one was one of the silver companies, one of the larger silver companies. And I left that in 2019 and thought, okay, I love a good story, I have to be honest. And, I am a salesman's dream that I will buy just about anything. But I bought Cameco shares at sort of $17, and they've gone exceptionally well. Bought Kazatomprom because they had a dividend, and over the years that's just done magic. But like you, I then bought some silver bullion. And just like you, last week I thought, well, you can't get much better than $100 an ounce. So I sold them. So, it's a heck of a market right now.
It's a heck of a market. And it's almost a little bit scary. I mean, I watch, of course, I speak to a lot of experts in the space, and a lot of people I'm speaking to, they're talking like, this is potentially a long term. It's potentially 10 years, but I look at the speed and it also scares me a little bit. But I mean, I'm hoping for it to slow down, if I'm honest with you, and a bit of a cool off, because you don't want it to go too nuts, because that's often what happens at the end of cycles. But you told me, you said you went to Zambia in 1973. So that was, there was a decade there, wasn't there, I think? That Rick Rule always talked to me about the decade of the 1970s. So it was quite a period, wasn't it?
Mm. Well, remember, you had the oil disruption during that time. Mm. It caused all sorts of dramas. I wouldn't. And then when the early 80s came around, there was a major recession because of the oil disruption in the UK. And all we used to get, because we never got internet in those days, and you used to get letters, and occasionally the Financial Times would come over. And that's when I knew my eyes were going, because that pink copy was difficult to read. But it was all doom and gloom. So there are cycles. You know, one of the things, just because you mentioned it, for me, I worked with Goldfields, I was also up in northern Finland in the Arctic Circle, right up in the northern part up there. Spent 3 winters at some strange temperatures, hitting as low as minus 60. But we were in platinum and palladium, and it depended on the price of the metal that you could substitute one for the other. So which kind of balanced out just how high some of these things could go. And I guess I mention it because, you know, if you start pushing the commodities too much, there's a risk that substitution will come in and something else will come into the environment, will drive prices down. It's great while we can, and we should enjoy it while we can. And, get yourself back to what get yourself a good project, because I always thought that if I'm putting a project together, can I be somewhere around the lower quartile of operating costs? Because if I can achieve that, then I'm there for a long time as well as good time.
Well, that's where we've got to look for now, isn't it? Because the miners haven't really moved, particularly silver miners, for example, they haven't really moved yet. Another key thing I picked up from a fund manager at the show in London in December was he told me that because of the expanding margins, a lot of these mid-tier companies have now become what you would call top-tier companies, and they've got a lot of cash sitting on their balance sheet looking to deploy it. Yes. And he said now, and people took profits as well, but he's looking at the next level down. And that was a real key phrase he said to me. He's now looking at the developers. So he's looking at companies that are pre-DFS or just getting into DFS or with a mine plan. So the money is now starting to move down. Eventually it will move down, of course, to the juniors, which will move last. I'd like to get your opinion on sort of where you think, what do you think this is, right? Perhaps thinking about back to previous cycles and what they were like, I think, Most people will agree, I think we're in now a mining bull cycle, but I wonder what you think, and also just what you make of it, and perhaps how long it will last, and just what do you think's going on?
Well, remember my vintage. So I think the advance of technology has been absolutely outstanding. I guess in your age group, it's normal. But for me, it's still, wow, can we do that now? That is fantastic. And how quick can we do it? But still, the two main key elements in our life are commodities and farming. They are the two basics. You cannot do without each other. And as technology, particularly now with this, the AI approach that's moving with speed, it's the demand for power that seems to be catching all the
power. Exactly. It's all about power, I think.
Yeah. So that's copper, unless you substitute it with another element. I mean, all metals are conductive. It's just which one's more conductive and easier to get. But it's power, it's nuclear, and therefore it's uranium. And, you know, the politics of the world today, it's got to be gold, just because, you know, you need something to hang on to. And, you know, you hear, like, right or wrong, you hear stories in the newspapers that suggest that one of the risks we have with AI is their ability potentially to create certain algorithms or programs that can access Bitcoin. And therefore your Bitcoin might not be as safe as you thought it was, kind of thing, driving people back to the gold environment. Interesting one for silver, because I listen quite carefully to the silver market, is just how much silver there is above ground. Just like you and me, you know, there's a large number of people who hold silver in coins or whatever shape or form, or jewelry. And right now, it's probably worth a while melting some of that down and giving ourselves some money.
Maybe.
The cycle will continue, but for how long? You know, I've no better crystal ball than anyone else.
No, but it's nice, isn't it? And I have actually just looked on the Royal Mint, because I do dollar cost average gold sovereigns every month. And of course, I used to buy one every month. Now it was more like every 2 or 3 months, but I actually can't buy it now.
Wow.
They're not in stock, which also is a warning sign
that the
public are all going nuts for it.
Over, so it's here, due to come over back. Here in North America, Costco sell gold coins now across in shops.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. Quite strange.
Amazing.
Isn't it just? The world is a wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree on energy, though. It's energy, energy, energy. I think energy is, the universal currency. I really feel that.
Yeah. One, Ian, one commodity you didn't mention though that I wanted to ask you about, because it's been such a big focus of your career, is lithium. Because obviously it's had a difficult few years, but the price has risen quite considerably since mid-2025. I just wonder if you think it's going to continue to rally. Are the drivers there? What are they in the first instance?
Look, it is, again, it's battery storage. I think more than electric vehicles will be the key element here, and it's associated with that power we've just touched on briefly. I am the executive chairman of Bradahead, and we've just announced in the last 48 hours that we have entered into a joint venture earning agreement with Rio Tinto Zinc in America, adjacent to our existing properties, which for us is a bit of a game changer, and I think a big change going forward for America, knowing that you can have a hard rock producer in that country. And with the politics that exist in that country, I think we're well suited for the future going forward. And I think we're a great investment opportunity, and it's big enough to be important in America. And we continue to look for opportunities in that company. But going back to your question on lithium, we've had two waves. We had the first one, and it started off with mobile phones and batteries for that, and people realizing that perhaps there was more usages of it. And we went trailing up to great prices and then crashed back down in 2019, 2020. That's what gave us the opportunity of getting the assets into Brada at a very low price at the time. We then had a second wave that went back up and has come back down. And we're now in the third wave, because you're right. The spodumene price is now circa sort of $2,400 a ton, but it was as low less than 12 months ago at about $600, $700. So suddenly it's a good marketplace again. But one of the things I'm always conscious of in my own assessment is, you know, how much latent capacity is there that people have switched off? So I'll give you an example of that. Was over in Canada with the uranium business. Some of the Cameco, for example, switched off a couple of its operations. Now, they don't switch them off in a way that just closes them completely. They have to keep them in what they call care and maintenance, as you know, a lot of people did in actual fact in different projects. And so they're able to switch them back on fairly quickly and start to satisfy a lot of the immediate demand because the pricing is good. And the same to some extent applies in the lithium marketplace. There has been companies that have switched off production, etc., etc. They've already spent the capital. So for them, they don't have to go out and raise copious amounts of money. It's just really sufficient to bring it back into production. And there is a bit of latent capacity in the lithium market. But still, I go back to the Brada story. The reason it differentiates us is we're in America with it. And the commentary that comes out of that country these days is you know, let's make America great again.
Homegrown
supply. Yep.
Absolutely. So that JV with Rio, then, that's pretty significant, really, isn't it?
My presentation, I we work with Tavistock along the lines of how we present ourselves, etc. And I can't help myself for throwing in some stupid comments. And I think it's the third page of our new presentation that says, one small step for lithium in the USA, one giant step for Bradahead. So I think it is quite significant.
Yeah. And so what's your focus at the moment as executive chairman? Are you getting down and dirty with the lithium, or are you sort of sitting at a higher level?
No, I can't help myself. I like to touch the ground and see what's going on. I live in Vancouver these days. It was either Cape Town or Vancouver, but Vancouver has become my current business. Spent more time here than anywhere except Scotland, to be honest. I've now been here almost 14 years, which is a long time in my life. But I still love to travel and get about. So as a youngster, going back to that 1970 job, I think in my head was, wow, it'd be great to go and see all these places. Well, I've been lucky enough to do it, and I've been lucky enough to do it because people have sent me there, or I've sent myself there, in new business and opportunities. And I think that's still, I've got sand in my shoes, and that's just not going to change. So I do look around for opportunities.
Good. Well, that was nice to get a bit of history about yourself, your thoughts, of course, on the cycles and the commodities. I don't know if you want to finish. I always like to ask this question, but you don't, of course, have to answer it. But yeah, what do you have any predictions, any thoughts on the year? Or maybe if you don't want to go down that road, just maybe tell us what you think is going to happen with Brada, with how you're building things there.
Well, look, Brada Brada has a great opportunity here. It really does. We've got strong investment backing from an excellent group of people, not least of which is a friend of mine called Jim Mellon, who was with us in the Euromin story way back in 2005, was with me in the Brazilian gold story, because I haven't spent much time talking to you about what we did in South America, but I was down there for a few years and put a couple of mines together. Overall, I should just add, just to finish the conversation, I started from putting the resources together, doing a feasibility study, a mine plan, building, and then commissioning mines. I've started 12 mines from start to finish. And so, you know, I look back and I think, it's been absolutely stunning. Going forward, Brad has got a great chance. I really do think there's an opportunity here. Good support. The market's fun. If you don't enjoy it now, you'll never enjoy it, honestly. And life has just been wonderful for me, and I'm in a position where if it's not fun, why would I do it? You know, I'm now 75, exactly. So why would I do it? And it's just because it's fun. You work with good people and you have good times with them.
Well, yeah, indeed. Mm-hmm. You're definitely a mine builder. I hope I'm still around for another cycle or two. I might only get one more, and I hope I'm still as excited as you when I'm 75. But
no, great stuff.
Ian Stalker, thank you very much for joining us today.
No, thank you for the opportunity. Thanks, guys.
Yes.